You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Here we are, another week of Royals baseball. I am your host to discuss it with you, Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, the effervescent Michael Engel. I'm running out of adjectives here. I try to come up with a new one every week. Most of the time it fails, but that was what came to my mind. Yes, that would probably be a good idea. That was just kind of spur of the moment here. I like to keep it fresh. So, but anyway, Michael, how are you doing tonight?
It was a lot better until James Shields gave up a grand slam here, and this card's not fun.
You know, it wouldn't be a Kansas City baseball vault without a few gremlins, and we had to work some out. And so Mike had to hang up the call, and then figure it out, and then call me back. And as I was waiting for him to call back, I got that notification on my phone about that. And you know, normally I get a notification, I look in, I'm like, okay, you know, what are the circumstances? You know, who did what? But I saw that and I was like, must have been a grand slam. So
yeah.
I'll wait. I'll recap that later.
Sorry about that, everyone.
But anyway,
that's probably on us.
Yeah, and by the way, this is June 3rd. We're recording, so that's what we're referencing in case you're listening to this at a later date. But before James Shields gave up a grand slam, we actually had some decent things to talk about. We were pretty dejected last show. The Royals had lost 5 of 6. Things were looking really bad. They were 24-28, I believe. And I think they had just been swept by the Houston Astros. It was just looking down. But as the Royals are wont to do, they scraped together some wins and may give you back that hope, like, okay, well, they can, you know, maybe they can stick around. They're still not that far out. And are they just delaying the inevitable? Are they maybe just getting past some early season skids? Who knows? It remains to be seen. But either way, they had a pretty good showing out in Toronto. Toronto comes in to that series, the hottest team in the American League. They'd won 9 straight games, and the Royals just out of the gate rip off 2 right away. Now, one of them was basically the Toronto Blue Jays gave away a game about as Royal-like as you could possibly imagine, but not even like this year's Royals, like 2005 Royals. Like, was it the 9th inning? And they have an error throwing to home plate, was it? I'm trying to remember the sequence of events. Or it was Jose Reyes.
The big one was he threw it a little bit in front of Encarnacion, and
that's what
he didn't scoop it. And the Royals were able to turn that into, you know, that would have been the last out of the game, I believe. And they could have, that could have been a big one, but the Royals ended up, you know, taking advantage, which they've rarely kind of done. They're able to tie it up, and then they actually get 2 in the top of the 10th, and they won that game. And then that was good, and that was right after, you know, losing, you know, 2 out of 3 against the Angels and then getting swept by Houston at home. So to come out and actually kind of get that win, it felt good. I mean, it was tense, and it was nice to, you know, it looked bad, but they were kind of bailed out. They won the next game 6-1 and hit a couple homers. Lorenzo Cain drove in 4. Then it kind of turned south again. They lost the next 2 against Toronto, and Saturday's game was just pretty miserable.
Mark Burley just had his way with the Royals lineup, as he has done for his entire career, more or less. It was the game that the Royals won in 10 with after the error. I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, sometimes in order to get off the schneid, you just kind of need something regardless of what it is. And it looked like maybe that was it, you know, okay, the Blue Jays gave him a win, but whatever, it gets them off the losing skid and they can maybe kind of put some wins together, and they won the next game. And then it was kind of back to where they were. And they've kind of, I mean, we're seeing a pattern here. And I mean, it's no longer in that territory where it's, hey, the Royals are going to come out of this, they're going to do better, the offense is going to magically improve. You know, I mean, people, I think, just probably need to start coming to grips with this is what the Royals are going to be. You know, the fortunate scenario for them is we may be at reaching a level of parity in baseball where that still means the playoffs are attainable if a few things swing right. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, this kind of hovering around 400 business is more or less the way it's going to go, I think. And they, I mean, they're, you know, they, after the two losses to Toronto, then they go down to St. Louis to play the Cardinals, who Cardinals are struggling a little bit, but, you know, I would 90% of the time you ask me, are the Cardinals a better team? I don't have to look at the stats. I don't have to look at who's playing. I don't have to, what, yes, this is probably the answer.
Right.
I mean, the Cardinals have had an impressive 10-year run here. But, I mean, so they go down to the Cardinals, and you're like, okay, they got the Cardinals, and then they got the Cardinals in Kauffman, and they got the Yankees. I mean, this could spell trouble, but they go down and they rip one off, right, you know, 6-0 over the Cardinals. I mean, that's the kind of beatdown the Cardinals usually give the Royals in Kauffman. So it was good to see that last night. But then again, now, as we just mentioned, James Shields has already given up. It's not even 7 o'clock when we're recording. We started this recording, and James Shields has already given up a grand slam. So, you know, that's kind of where we're at to catch up from our last recording, which is to say not much different. Like I said, we were 24-28, or the Royals were 24-28 last recording, and now they are 27-30. So I guess they picked up a game, but if they can't get back those four runs tonight, then it's going to be right back to 27-31. So a couple bright spots, I suppose. We talked last time about Jordano Ventura kind of avoiding the big injury bug, this, you know, knock on wood, this Tommy John epidemic, so to this point anyway, and he should be back this Saturday. But another pitcher, you know, we were kind of wondering about Danny Duffy, who had more or less a similar issue to Jordano Ventura. He had to leave a game. He had what he referred to as a dead arm. The Royals were, you know, they basically said the same thing. There was nothing wrong, but just kind of the way he termed it was, you know, I just reached back and there was nothing there. but then he comes out, and he was who pitched last night in the series opener against the Cardinals. And I mean, 6 innings. No,
one hit,
one walk, 5 strikeouts. I mean, that is the Danny Duffy the Royals need in this rotation for the foreseeable future. So, I mean, what were your thoughts on that? I mean, what are you liking from Danny Duffy that you've seen versus some of the issues he's had?
Well, he's when he's on, he's really good. That game where he got lit up a little bit, he was thrown like high 80s, and we didn't really talk about it that much because it was overshadowed a lot by Ventura's injury and Kyle Zimmer's injury, and James Shields has got a base hit.
Nice.
Go figure. So that it just kind of snuck in there behind those other higher profile injuries, even though Duffy's just as important as Ventura to this team, because you saw on Saturday when the Royals had to go to Aaron Brooks that they don't really have starting pitching depth right now.
No.
I mean, it's tough. Aaron Brooks is a guy they really like as a strike thrower, and he had no command, and he got rocked.
Just
and
awful.
I felt really bad for him watching it, but it also freed up my afternoon, so that's okay.
Yes, I went and saw Godzilla, thankfully. So
yeah, yeah, which was probably even less of a disaster.
Hey-o. And what's interesting here, too, is something that, you know, not a lot of people have talked about, but just kind of a random thought. I mean, no one's really talked about Kyle Zimmer really that much, except for his injuries, because he's been injured. He hasn't really done much to talk about. But, I mean, this is a scenario where had Kyle Zimmer been ready at the start of the season and started pounding away, and I can't remember if they said they were going to start him in AA or AAA, I think, did it double A?
I think it's probably double A.
Yeah, because that's where, he was there last year, and he did pretty well, but I think they still wanted to give him more time. But, had he blown everything away for the month of April in double A, then I don't think they would have hesitated to move him to triple A. And then if he had spent a month down there doing pretty well, then this is a scenario where, a spot start, you could pull up a Kyle Zimmer. And if he does really well in his first start, then maybe it's something where you just leave him up there and you find a space. That's kind of a missed opportunity for him because of the injuries. And, who knows if he actually would have been ready? Probably not. But it's, at worst, he comes up and gets a spot start. And if he gets shelled just like Aaron Brooks, at least he gets a taste of the big leagues so he can kind of know what he's going, and then settle in back in the minors and then come up later. But
yeah,
we're probably not going to see Kyle Zimmer in 2014.
No, I don't think we are. And, they might have brought, hypothetically, if he would have been ready to start the year yet, they might have brought him up. There would also be 40-man roster situations and, the service time. And
yeah, a lot of things to consider.
So it wouldn't have been a slam dunk, I don't think. But, if the guy's throwing well, they'd probably want to get him up here. Obviously, that couldn't happen because he hasn't thrown. He's like two innings in an extended spring training game, and that's about it. But that Saturday game, with Brooks on the hill, they seemed like they were ready to just concede it. Like, they didn't have big expectations for it. They gave Sal the day off. They gave Kane the day off. They gave Infante the day off. And, by the third inning, there was no need to bring any of those guys in. Yeah, so
it was game over.
Yeah, it was just... it was just a really rough day. And then the next day, they didn't do anything on offense. And it was another one of those days where two runs feels like the biggest gap you could ever try to overcome. And it's really tough sometimes because this offense is really inconsistent. When they're league average, they look pretty good because you get good defense and good pitching. But if they're not, they're pretty miserable. And even despite that, they haven't been too streaky. You talked about they were 24 and 28 last time we recorded, and now they're really only one game different. It's not like they've gone on big losing streaks. It's just like they seem to go on these 1-4 stretches, and then they have like a 3-1 stretch, and then they go back to 1-4. So it's just like these weird swings that never really get too extreme, but they're coming out behind on the bad ones more often than they're coming out ahead on the good ones. And so they're not really looking like anything more than a 500 team at this stage. And, there's not a lot of life out there. It's kind of difficult to watch because this is supposed to be the year, but nothing's really developed that way. So it's pretty tough.
And it's, there's a lot of just surprising stuff too. Cause you think, okay, Billy Butler is not going to hit as poorly as he has all season, but he's not showing any signs here. I shouldn't say that because he's starting to hit the ball a little bit better, but he's not, just all of a sudden, boom, breaking out now. So, he needs to get better, and you didn't see that coming. And it's, it's one of those kind of frustrating points where you wish in one hand and what in the other, and see what happens first, right? Because you're like, okay, I think this team can get better. I want them to get better, and I can see where it could get better, but I don't see how it gets better because you look at it just. It's tough to watch them. Like you said, there's no life out there. The offense is just putrid. The Cardinals are the second worst team in the majors when it comes to hitting home runs. And before they homered off Grand Slam off of James Shields tonight when we record this, they only had 30, I believe. And the only team worse than that was the Royals with 26. So, it seems like there's this constant kind of tug of war with the Royals of trying to embrace the fact that they can't hit home runs, but then trying to force themselves to hit more home runs. And we've kind of talked about it a little bit previously on this show, but it's that the offense is just so disconcerting, and you don't, it's, last season was good, but it's like you said, with the streaks, you know, they've just kind of come out on the bad end on a little too, you know, more than they have on the good end for some of them so far. Well, and basically the same thing happened last year, and they just happened to come out on the good end of a lot of them more, because really, you know, they had the 15 out of 20 streak, or 16 out of 20, or however many it was after the All-Star break, and they started 17 and 10 early in the season. Then they had the 4-19 stretch in May, and then, you know, outside of those, they were basically a 500 team, and everything kind of worked it out so that it's they ended up finishing, you know, 10 games over 500. But you know, this year they could be exactly the same, but just have no really long bad stretch and no really long good stretch, and then end up, you know, a little bit worse. I mean, it's tough to kind of know what to expect from this team, but it's I don't know.
It's more likely that they're going to have a bad losing streak because the offense has been so bad. It's I mean, Butler's not good. He's had like two game stretches where he looks okay. But I mean, he still only has 10 extra base hits. And then, you know, Alex Gordon has been a lot better in the last month, but Hosmer hasn't hit in the last month.
I mean, he's dipping down to close to 260s. Is he in the 260s now?
Yeah.
For his batting average? I mean, he is really kind of fallen off the ledge here. And I heard on the radio this morning, I think over the last 2 weeks, he's been hitting 180.
Yeah, and so he's still, like, up there in league leaders in doubles. It's like when he does get a hit, it's a double, but you know, he hasn't looked very good at the plate, and they keep hitting him third, and I don't know what they're trying to accomplish there. Lorenzo Cain's been really good. He's been probably the most productive hitter in the lineup, even though, you know, he did have that DL stint, and he doesn't need a day off every now and then, and his power is really not there. So I don't think anybody expected the Royals to be building their offense around Alex Gordon and Lorenzo Cain. Maybe Gordon, but, you know, certainly not Cain. And when everybody else is hitting 250 and they're getting on base 30% of the time, like Billy Butler and Eric Hosmer and, you know, Alcides Escobar and Omar Infante and Nori Aoki, all those guys are right in that 250 range, 300 OBP. You know, that takes a toll. That's a lot of stuff to overcome there, and you know, you knew coming in it was going to be a little bit power deficient anyway, just because, you know, it's a bunch of guys with 20 home run ceilings, and so, you know, you had that up against you, and then they, you know, it's kind of evened out. They've hit a little bit more in the home run department lately, but still, I mean, they're still way behind everybody else, and you know, it ended up with, like we talked about last week, Mike Moustakas got sent down, but Danny Valencia got hurt right away. And so then Moustakas comes back up and, you know, still only hitting 150 and only got 8 games in Omaha. And apparently that's enough. But at the same time, it's also like, what were the options they could have gone with? Siriaco is not an everyday guy, and Jimmy Paredes is not an everyday guy, and Johnny Giovitella has never hit at the big league level, and Clone really isn't a third baseman, nor is he probably a great option for third.
A second baseman a shortstop, or
so they're in this spot where, you know, they're 8 years into Dayton Moore's tenure, and they, you know, an injury to Danny Valencia pretty much sends them scrambling, and that's not a good sign for any team or any lineup. And that's kind of where they were, that they had to, you know, Moustakas went 6 for his last 8 in Omaha, and they decided that was enough to call him up, so now he's back in the big leagues.
Yeah, and, you know, just to illustrate the Hosmer point, over the last 7 days, he's hitting 266 now. Over the last 7 days, he's hitting 192, 192, 308 for a 500 OPS. Last 2 weeks, 180, 208, 240 for a 448 OPS. And then the last month, even, it only gets slightly better at 233, 270, 301 for a 571 OPS. Those are Moustakas-like numbers there. But Hosmer gets off to a good start, so he's without repercussion. I mean, this is the guy that the Royals, you know, this was built around Eric Hosmer. You know, I think originally when they had the best farm system in the history of ever, you know, it was Mike Moustakas was their guy. And then a year later, it became clear that Eric Hosmer was the guy because he had the more talent. It was, and I think some people still, you know, even then still thought that Moustakas had more talent, or I'm sorry, that Hosmer had more talent, but that maybe Moustakas would get there first and take that role, you know, but now it's Eric Hosmer and he's the guy and they want him to succeed and they need him to succeed and they need him to be a leader and they need him to be everything else. And he's just none of it. Like, I don't see him being a leader. You know, I don't see him just kind of exuding that scary sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, swagger. Like when I remember when I was growing up and we used to, you know, the Royals just stunk all the time and big surprise, right?
Shocker. But,
you know, Mike Sweeney was, my dad always used to say whenever Mike Sweeney would bat, he'd be like, man, he goes, that is the only guy on this Royals team that pitchers are scared of, that looks like he's up there and he's just going to hit whatever. You give him a mistake, he's going to take care of it. And he was the only guy that evoked fear in an opposing team. And for the longest time, he was right. And we've talked about it before. You know, there's nobody on this team that evokes that fear, and it's supposed to be Eric Hosmer at the very least, and it's not him. So then the question becomes, well, you know, Mike Moustakas had his quote-unquote, you know, comeuppance, if you will, even though it was, now that he's back up, obviously depth is an issue, but it kind of seems like it was almost a sham just so that the fans would stop crowing about it. But when does Hosmer get his? You know, I mean, the dude is hitting, not only is it a 266 now, but it's an empty 266, and you had, you know, he's got one home run and 23 RBIs. Yeah, he's got a lot of doubles, but whoop-de-doo, the team's not scoring runs. So he gets on second base, and nobody hits him in, and nobody was on when he gets there. Well, big freaking deal. You know, it doesn't help much. So, and that's not necessarily his fault, but all the same, you know, if nobody's on base, you know, he needs to hit more home runs or something. You know, it's just there's. He it's like he gets a pass because he started off pretty hot and he was hitting 330 there for a while and staying above that 300 range. And everyone was like, okay, you know, Hosmer's a good player. But, and then I kind of heard this topic on the radio, and I'll be curious, you know, your thoughts on it, Mike. When they brought up Hosmer in 2011 and he kind of took off, had a really good rookie season, finished third rookie of the year voting. People were talking, lock him up now, do an Evan Longoria situation, a Carlos Gonzalez deal, where you sign him up now, and kind of like Salvador Perez and Alcides Escobar, he's here for a while, buy out a few free agency years, and it'll cost more now, but save you more later, and he's going to be a superstar, and we want him to be a Royal, and all this and that. I mean, and they brought up the point, what if the Royals had done that, and Hosmer had agreed to it? Then what would they be saying now? You know, if Hosmer was making Billy Butler money this year, if he was making $8 million this year, what would people be saying? I mean, people just killing Billy Butler for making $8 million. And Hosmer's not doing much better. And you have, you know, this idea that Scott Boras, his agent, was part of the reason why that the talks were kind of shut down back then, because I think the Royals were all for it.
Yeah,
but they were riding him. He was like a golden goose type of player. We're not signing this contract. We're going to do our 6 years. We're going to serve our time more or less. We're going to get out, and he's going to go sign a $200 million contract with the Yankees. Well, good freaking luck. And the point they kind of brought up, I think this was 810. It was on Border Patrol. You know, I think it was Jamie Bluma was the guest that they had on. He was talking. He goes, you know, a lot of these players we know aren't going to be here in Kansas City for their whole careers. That's not necessarily a Royals thing. That's just an any place thing because that's baseball now. But, you know, when Hosmer steps on the field, he's not just playing for the Royals right now. He's playing for whatever team is going to sign him to that monster contract. At what point does he look at it and say, this is unacceptable. I need to get better. I need to do something. Same deal with Moose. Same deal with any of those guys. You know, I mean, it's just kind of that age-old question. But, I mean, I thought that was an interesting topic. I mean, I don't know. I mean, don't you think that there needs to be – we've talked about accountability before, but I think it needs to be there for Hosmer just as much as anybody else.
Well, he does get a pass, it seems, from the organization. One, you know, because he did kind of salvage 2012, but I think a lot of times...
2013, you mean?
No, I mean, in 2012, he had that awful start, and he kind of chipped back up to it and finished strong, and then 2013 was a good rebound. And then he started out pretty well this year, despite, you know, the home runs. But, you know, that does kind of stick out because now, you know, he hasn't hit well. I think the Royals are probably more comfortable considering this is just a, you know, a slump and not like a big judgment of his talent. Because I think with Moustakas, there's significant questions because he's been good for basically 2 months of his big league career, and the rest has been just a big struggle. Hosmer's at least had, you know, sustained stretches of good hitting and good defense and everything else. But I mean, a couple of years ago, I was all for signing up to that kind of extension and, you know, dump, you know, $100 million on 8 years for him and keep the guy around. I was all for it. He looked every part, you know, that guy, you know, the guy you build your lineup around, the guy who, you know, there's always, you know, that freeze frame shot, that preview shot of the guy waiting, lurking in the on deck circle is the big threat that the team has to be afraid of. You know, your big poppy guy and things like that. I mean, Hosmer was supposed to be our Freddie Freeman. He was supposed to be our Paul Goldschmidt. He was supposed to be that kind of guy, and he hasn't been that guy. So
and he was, by the way, ranked higher than those guys and at the time, you know. So and this can kind of segue into our next point here. You know, there was an article that's come out this week that I actually haven't been able to read yet, unfortunately, but Mike's read it, and you can kind of hit some of the finer points. But it was by Rainey Giuzzierli, who, you know, is the founder of Baseball Prospectus, you know, just a really sharp baseball mind and a huge Royals fan for those who don't know who he is. Very outspoken also about the Royals and about their developmental issues. And that's what his article was about. He actually had a guest column for the Kansas City Star. You know, this isn't just his blog site. Not that makes really that much of a difference, really, because the information wouldn't change. But, you know, where he kind of called out the organization for their developmental tactics. And, you know, so like I said, Mike, you read it. So can you kind of go over some of the finer points and then we can kind of discuss.
Yeah. The basic idea is that the Royals are in this spot because the organization hasn't developed their players. You look at 2011, the Royals brought up Eric Hosmer. They brought up Mike Moustakas. They brought up Johnny Giovitella. Towards the end of the year, they got Sal Perez up. And none of those guys are hitting as well as they were in 2011. Now, Hosmer's not hitting the same way he was. I mean, last year he had, you know, he hit 300. He was kind of looking at 200 hits late, you know, but still not a lot of power in any of that. Giovitella, I mean, we've talked about him forever. I mean, if he's going to figure it out at the big league level, it's not going to be in Kansas City. Perez, his numbers have fallen every year since he has been a rookie, and you know, Moustakas, as we've seen, is just miserable. And it's, you know, you look top to bottom through the lineup, and that's a significant amount of guys because they couldn't develop Giovitella. They have to go expend resources on Omar Infante, and because they couldn't develop pitching, they had to trade Will Myers, which led to, you know, Noriaki out there, who's a fine guy, but definitely has his flaws. And so this all, it goes top to bottom in the organization. And so you look at things like Bubba Starling, who's hitting 200 in high A, and the example we gave before where Moustakas goes down and Valencia gets hurt and they have nobody. Their next closest guy who could probably have played third would have been maybe Chesler Cuthbert, who's just in double A. And, you know, their best prospects right now are in A ball and far from the majors. And, you know, you end up, Jason Adam is not quite where I think they thought he would be. I feel like they wanted him to be able to start in Omaha, and he hasn't been doing great in double A. So, there's just a lot of problems with, you know, the player development where these guys have not turned into who they thought they would be. Duffy's kind of starting to show some signs. Ventura's kind of getting there. But otherwise, it's a lot of bullpen guys, and that's all the Royals have really developed. I mean, Randy didn't really go too much into like the bullpen and everything, but it's basically that the Royals had all of these great names and they haven't developed them into, you know, fearsome major leaguers. And so what the result is this lineup where it's being carried by Lorenzo Cain pretty much, and great for Lorenzo Cain, and that's not to say anything about his numbers because he's actually been hitting pretty well, but he's not the guy that you build him around. That's a guy who they had slotted in seventh, eighth in the lineup, and you just can't – you can't have that guy be your top producer. And
he's the kind of guy where everything over 250 is gravy. You know, I mean, yeah. that's just the kind of guy he is. Nothing wrong with that. It still makes you an average to above average major league player, especially with his defense. But like you said, you don't build your offense around someone like that.
Yeah, it needs to be Hosmer. It needs to be Butler. It needs to be Gordon, Moustakas, and Perez. I mean, on paper, before the season, that lineup of Aoki, Infante, Hosmer, Butler, Gordon, Perez, Moustakas looked pretty solid, because that's a lot of up and coming guys, you felt like, but none of them really done it. Sal's been okay, I guess, in some regards. I mean, he does have five homers.
He's been really streaky.
Gordon's been good, and he's been really consistent in the last month or so, but that's about it. Just not a lot of pop from anybody, and it's tough to do anything. It's tough to get any momentum when you're struggling to score two or three runs every night, and it's I don't know.
And it seems to me, and this is kind of based on some whispers I've heard from, you know, people who have just that we've all kind of heard from people who have, you know, at least been around or seen the organization, and it seems to me, like, using my own suppositions and what I've heard, that there's a lot of inconsistency in the organization, and that goes, it's pervasive. It goes throughout pitching, batting. You know, they're taught one thing at one level, and then something's different at another level. And you know, there's always tweaks that different coaches can and advice that they can give you. But I'm talking like wholesale philosophies and things that change based on. You know, it's just not. You have a lot of organizations that will, you know, you look at like the Rays and the A's and the Orioles and different ones like that, and we know that they have a central philosophy that they send down the ladder all the way to the you know, rookie league, extended spring training. You know, it's all consistent philosophies. And, you know, you can obviously mold those and change them for players, and that's the whole point, but everything is consistent, and you don't get that from the Royals. And the impression I get is that, you know, not only are they constantly changing these things throughout the system, but then when they get up to the majors, then they try and change it again, and they try and say, okay, well, you know, the Eric Hosmer or Mike Moustakas or whoever was able to work through all these different changes in philosophy and whatever mechanical changes they wanted them to make, and actually made it, and they've shown some, you know, some success, very little in Moustakas's case and a decent amount in Hosmer's. Well, now we're going to try and change it again. So,
yeah,
you know, we were saying, you know, just swing at every fastball you see in the minors or whatever it is. And then we bring them up to the majors and they say, oh, no. Well, that hasn't been working for us. So now we want to do plate discipline. Now we want you to walk, and then we want to hit home runs. So we still want you to swing really hard and hit home runs, and you need to hit home runs, and we have to hit home runs, but we also want you to be patient, and you can't hit home runs in Kauffman, so don't try and hit home runs. And wait a second, what are you saying? Well, you know. So, and I feel like that happens a lot, and we've heard the general manager, the manager, the hitting coaches step all over themselves saying contradictory things time after time. You know, I mean, you have your 2 years ago, your manager saying that six different people on the team can hit 25 to 30 home runs. And then a year after that, you have a hitting coach saying, well, we're never going to hit a lot of home runs here, and we're never going to lead the league in least home runs hit, or whatever the hell he said. And then he gets fired, and then you have another guy come in and he gets fired, and
yeah,
there's all these.
They're on like their fifth or sixth hitting coach in the last two and plus years. So, I mean, that can't help either when you're a player and you're having some struggles and you're working on with the fifth guy that you've worked with since you've been called up. I mean, that can't help.
And the problem is when you go through the minors, and especially when you're someone like an Eric Hosmer who just has so much God-given talent that no matter what philosophy you try and get him to abide by, no matter who he's going up against, on those lower level competition, against that lower level competition, he's going to succeed. And so the problem is,
there's no negative feedback when he does it poor process or approach.
Exactly. So then you get up to the major leagues, and you know that one pitcher that you couldn't hit in the minor leagues. Well, that's every day now. And so someone like Eric Hosmer, then, well, he doesn't know how to truly, you know, advance. And then the Royals take that and they say, well, you know, he did it in the minors, so he's just better. He's going to get better. And they're like, well, we need to have a new hitting coach. We'll fire Pedro Grifol. We'll fire Jack Maloof. We'll get somebody else in here who, you know, Dale Swaim, he's good. He knows what he's doing. He'll make some tweaks, and Hosmer will be back on that 300 train, and everything will be great. And, you know, it's, you have to start wondering when it's going to be too late. You know, these, at some point you stop. You know, the reason that baseball drafts players out of high school and starts so young is because you want to develop a correct skill set at a young enough age that they can still adapt to changes and still evolve. But you get to a certain point where, you know, it's harder and harder to change back or to even change forward to something new. You know, and that's part of the reason that Bubba Starling is struggling so much, because he's old for his age. That's kind of a weird saying, but, you know, he was, for his grade, probably makes a little bit more sense to say it, but, you know, he was a little bit older. He was 19 just a month after he was drafted, before he ever played a major league game. And now he's 21 and he's playing with, you know, a bunch of kids that are a year or two younger than him. And they're, have that mental, and Jason Parks talked about it on his show last time we had him on last year, talking about Bubba Starling, where he just, that cognitive ability to be able to recognize pitches and do those things, that decreases as you get older. And when you're the older you get, the harder it is to kind of snap back and make those wholesale changes. And so, you know, the question is, have the Royals ruined these guys? Are they too old to, they're not that old, but in a baseball sense, are they too old to really kind of move back and be able to adapt to all these changes that people are making to get him? Because we haven't seen it from Moustakas. And, you know, and that's kind of another article we wanted to hit on that's similar, not necessarily about Moustakas, but something that Joe Posnanski, a former writer for The Star, wrote. And he talked about kind of what they're doing in Oakland, and more or less kind of Moneyball 2, if you will. But it's a long article. I haven't been able to read the whole thing, and Mike hasn't either, but we kind of got the gist of what he's talking about and what the A's are doing.
It's really good.
Yeah, really. And
what I've read of it, I tried to read it at work, which, you know,
that never works out well.
Once I realized, oh, this is, you know, a 4,000-word article. Yeah, it's like, I can't do this at work. So
yeah, sorry, he doesn't mince words, that Joe Posnanski. But no. Let's see. And I'm going to pull out you. We had in our email chain today, Mike kind of highlighted a quote. But
yeah, they were talking about Brandon Mott. I mean, they're talking about the A's. So there's a lot of finding guys and getting great value and production out of them. And the approach is basically that the A's are trying to not fall into traps. They're not trying to, you know, go with the convention. They're always skeptical of the common wisdom, I guess. And so, you know, when they see a guy, they want to really make sure that he's somebody. And I think they're talking about Brandon Moss in the bit that that I pulled together.
Yeah,
I think that's what it was.
And it's, the article was kind of focused on, I hope I get this name right, but Ferhan Zaidi, who is the assistant GM. Is that right? More or less?
Yeah, he's the assistant GM to Billy Beane, and VP of baseball ops. He's basically the second in command.
Yeah, the J.J. Piccolo to Billy Beane's Dayton Moore, if you will. But so the quote goes like this. This is the quote from the article, not necessarily a quote from a person, but it says, so does that mean Moss is an, this is again, Brandon Moss, you said, right? For this.
Yep.
Yeah. So does that mean Moss is an everyday player? Well, maybe. But as Zaidi says, and now we're getting into perhaps the most significant point of Moneyball 2, the A's do not take anything for granted. They do not go into the season believing that anybody will get 600 plate appearances or make 35 starts or will have as good a year as last year. Billy Beane makes it clear they will not make decisions based on what they hope will happen. Optimism is not a strategy. And that quote goes down like a cool glass of water on a hot day, because that is more or less one of the major points that we have been trying to get across on this show for a long time. And none of us are as talented with words as Joe Posnanski, so that more or less sums it up. But just this idea that the Hosmer's not just going to magically get better. Moustakas is not going to go down to Omaha for a week and get better. Billy Butler's not going to just get better. And Alex Gordon and all the rest of them, you know, like the Royals not only need to be proactive in helping these players get better, which it doesn't appear they've been. It appears they're usually reactive, where, okay, we don't think anything's wrong with Hosmer's swing, but he's hitting, you know, under 200 for the last month or 230 for the last month. So, well, now we need to tweak his swing.
Yeah, now we got to do something.
Because the Royals are a results-based organization.
Moustakas just doubled as you said that.
Yeah, Moustakas just doubled. He's fixed. He's fixed. Look at that. You know, I mean, and the point is, you know, that's how the Royals think, it seems like. And we have enough quotes to kind of piece together that's not necessarily a stretch to say that's how they operate. And here you have the A's, who are legitimately the best team in the American League this year. And, you know, Billy Beane, some people try and turn him into a punchline, and I'm sure he doesn't care, because, you know, he's just going to go out there and win 90 games the last 3 years, win the American League West the last 3 years, even, you know, with teams like the Rangers and the Angels. And, you know, that's not necessarily any. He's got the Mariners in there this year, too, just spent $250 million on Robinson Cano. You know, the A's just continue to win with these different philosophies. People try and pick on and say it's stupid or whatever, but you know, whatever. You call my GM stupid if they're winning 90 games a year.
Yeah. The central idea is really that they're always questioning where they can get better and how they can kind of make things work. And now they have a very fluid kind of platoon system where anybody on their bench could start on any given day and they're going to be fine. You know, and they can maximize their matchups, and they can take care of everything so that, you know, their lineup doesn't have a hole every day. And so that's a good thing, and it enables them to do things like Brandon Moss, who they were talking about. You know, he hit 26 homers against right-handers. They were able to put him in a position to maximize his skills, and they got 30 homers out of the guy. So that's tough to. I just don't get how you can laugh at that, even if it is, you know, okay, well, it's just, you know, you don't play it on a spreadsheet. Well, no, but you do have to have some common sense to it. So it's I don't know. It's a weird thing to be angry at them for doing things like that. That just, in a way, is just common sense. You know, don't take it for granted and don't just expect things to get better. It's like, you know, the Dayton Moore quote where he's like, we're going to get better every day, and then one day we're going to wake up and we're going to be good. Or Ned Yost saying that, okay, well, Sal's a 30-home-run guy and Moose is a 35-home-run guy and Hosmer's a 30-home-run guy, and you just believe it. And that's great to have that optimism, but the last line is the killer. Optimism is not a strategy. And you saw it again when they switched to Dale Swaim. Yost was saying, well, sometimes just hearing a different voice is fine. Okay. Fine.
Yeah. Okay. All
right.
Whatever,
man.
If assuming, even if that voice is saying the wrong thing, you know, which Dayton Moore's probably telling both hitting coaches what to say, so it didn't really matter, you know? And I mean, maybe, I don't know. I don't know the inner workings of the organization to know enough if Dayton Moore's out there telling them what to tell Hosmer or whatever, but I mean, it's perplexing. It's kind of a, not in a number sense, but it's kind of a mathematical way of looking at building a team.
It's and I logic. Say,
yeah, you
that's
know,
all it is.
That's a better way. It's a logical way, because it's you know, looking at it as a whole, right? The Royals look at it and they say, okay, we've got a nice piece in Eric Hosmer, we've got a nice piece in Billy Butler, and we've got a nice piece in Gordon and Perez and all those, and we're just going to throw them together and this is going to work. You know, it's like, well, you know, sometimes baseball, just the nature of the sport, that can happen. But the reason a team like the A's can be so successful for so long, and other teams are doing it too, but is because they look at it as a whole and they say, okay, where we've got 40 pieces on our 40-man roster, what's the best 25 we can put together to give us the most amount of wins playing them a certain way? You know, the Royals don't look at it like that. They look at it like, who are the you know, who are the best individual pieces, and then we'll slot them in wherever we can, wherever we can get them in.
James Shields just doubled.
Did he really? Is that two hits for James Shields?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Well, he's halfway to the cycle.
Wow. Good for him. So, all right.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's all right. And he got an RBI.
He did.
Right.
So his Royals first career double.
To 4-2 now. So James Shields trying. He's. I'll tell you what he is. He's pissed that he gave up that grand slam. So he's out there doing everything he can to get those runs back.
Shields now has four fewer doubles than Omar Infante.
There you go. Boom. But see, but back to the ultimate point, you know, it's why that people kind of get mad at us on Twitter for talking all this stuff. But it's why we get mad when you hear Dayton Moore and Ned Yost come out and say things like, oh, you know, he's a competitor. He's got that fire. We want people with grit. We want people with that are competitors. We want people that want to go out there and win. And it's like, that's just a bunch of BS. You know, it's just cliche, yeah, stupid stuff. And it's, you know, I mean, some of it is you have to say something to the media. And I get that. And if the Royals' actions were different than their words, then I would just pay it no mind and dismiss it. But their actions are exactly like what their words are. It's why Chris Getz starts for two seasons for this team. It's why Jeff Francoeur hung on for two seasons longer than he ever should have been. And you know, they value these things that just don't have any value on the baseball diamond. And it doesn't, I guess I shouldn't say that. I mean, there is some value to some of that intangible stuff. But
they,
I mean,
inflate the value of
exactly,
those things.
Exactly. And, you know, I think part of it, when we talk about the dichotomy between, you know, people trying to make light of Billy Bean and kind of put him down, it kind of comes back to this old school versus new school power struggle. And with that, there was another article that came out today that kind of, that talked about some unwritten rules of baseball. And I think when we come back on the other side, Mike and I are going to dive into this article here and kind of talk about what the implications are for current day baseball and what our thoughts are. So stick with us and we'll see you on the other side to talk about the unwritten rules of baseball.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters. Talking to the wall. Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I'm your host, Jeff Herr. With me is Michael Engel here for our second segment. And we want to talk about an article that came out on Deadspin today, written by Dick Hayhurst, former Major League Baseball pitcher. And the article is entitled, A Major League Pitcher's Guide to Baseball's Bullshit Unwritten Rules. So if that doesn't necessarily tip you off where this is going, then stay tuned, because we're getting there. But he kind of goes into, and it's something that, you know, I've kind of harped on this a little bit on baseball before, and especially on Twitter, and it usually happens when some form of retaliation takes place on the baseball diamond, whether it's you know, you hit our player, we're going to hit your player, or you showed up on a home run, and so we're going to show you up and hit you next time you come up, and all that business, you know. And I just think it's juvenile and dumb and whatever. But anyway, so he tries to pull together, you know, as many of these rules and kind of talks about them, and with his experience playing for a couple teams in the major leagues and just in general what he knows about baseball. And just kind of some of the interesting things that he said were, so he talked about when he was on the Blue Jays, Roy Halladay was there. And he said everyone was quiet in the presence of Roy Halladay. You got out of his way. He didn't talk to him during his routine. He kept the conversation short. He set the tone for the whole locker room. And when he was there, everyone in the organization said that everyone, all the players, should emulate his work ethic and how much the clubhouse was a place of business, because he was a veteran, he was a star, he was everything. And then when he left, everyone talked about how his personality made the clubhouse a dark and moody place and that they needed to know balance to succeed. So, you know, kind of interesting there that it's one of those like, whoa, well, we've got this really great player, so let's, you know, upsell him, and then he's gone, and it's like, well, we're better off, you know.
Yeah, it's which, a fun to play the narrative game.
Yes, we love the narrative game on this show. And
well, yeah, it's the same thing. It's not quite like an unwritten rule, but it's like when they talk about players who have emotion and when they're hitting, oh, that guy's he feeds off of it, he's better because of it. And if they show any emotion, they're not hitting, they're being distracting, or they're in their head or whatever. It happens all the time with Danny Duffy. You know, when he's pitching well, oh yeah, he's feeding on it. Or James Shields just as emotional and just pitches well more frequently or more consistently. Or Greinke. Greinke, same, you know, Greinke doesn't really show emotion, and so they, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like you need to be calm. Well, yeah. You know, it's if Zach Greinke's out there doing well, it's like, well, that's what you should be. You need to be calm out there on the mound and just don't show any emotion. But if James Shields is out there and he gives up a hit and he curses into his glove and then he goes out there and strikes out the side, well, oh, you need to feed off that emotion, just like you're saying. I mean, it's ridiculous. But
I'll stop interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. That's what this show's all about.
I was gonna say, like, you know, if you do get hit and you don't show much emotion, you know, for one person that might be stoicism, for another person that's indifference.
Yeah, and
it's just the narrative is just it's ridiculous.
Look at two perfect examples from the Royals. Jonathan Sanchez, he's out there on the mound, just stunk it up for the Royals for a half season. And just very stoic and, you know, didn't show a ton of emotion. People were just riding him. He doesn't care. He needs to get off the mound. The Royals need to get rid of him. He's a bad influence in the clubhouse, all this stuff. Irvin Santana, last year on the mound, very calm, collected, didn't show a lot of emotion. Just, oh, he's so laid back. That's why he stays control on the mound. He's so great. He's such a great example for the team. It's just that's not really necessarily exactly what the article was about, but that's an interesting point, and in that it's just baseball kind of bends things to its will, if you will, about to try and like you said earlier, change the narrative. But here's an interesting quote from Johnny Gomes that he put in his article. It says, so many rules and regulations have prevented the players from policing our game. Now a young guy hits a home run, he cruises around the bases, and then you hit him with the pitch to teach him a lesson and gets suspended 6 games. Is it worth it to make a point? No, the rules have been altered. You have a better opportunity to go out in the parking lot and fight a guy after a game than throwing at him. If you fight in the parking lot, you might not get suspended, but if you hit a guy, you're going to get suspended. I mean, this is a quote from a Major League Baseball player, folks, and this he's lamenting the fact that baseball is trying to crack down on the fact that you're on the I'm not trying to phrase this right, but the baseball is trying to crack down on the fact that what in the real world, outside of a baseball diamond and outside of the allure of professional sports, would be assault with a deadly weapon. I mean, if you threw a baseball at 95 miles an hour at somebody's head with the intention of hurting them, that's assault.
Yeah.
Clear, plain and simple, you know, by the book. And that's the kind of stuff that is very, very dangerous. And Major League's trying to crack down on that. And players are upset because they can't throw and endanger the health of other players and endanger the integrity of the game. And this is part of what I've always hated, because beyond the injury aspect, which is egregious, that players get so worked up about, you know, from a union standpoint, is, you know, whether it's football or baseball or whoever, of being put in a position to be injured. And yet when leagues make a step towards lessening that, then they get upset. And beyond all that, then you have, just from a competitive standpoint, I mean, you go out there, people say that they look at this like, oh, okay, well, you hit one of our guys, so we're going to hit yours, and that shows how competitive we are. It's like, well, the true nature of competition is to win. So if you're going to go out there and you're going to tell me that, you know, no one goes out there and says, you know what, I'm going to walk this guy just to prove a point. I'm going to give up a base hit just to prove a point. You know, you don't want to put that guy on first base. That is the number one goal that you do not want to do. Every pitcher is trying not to put somebody on base. And just because somebody got hit or somebody flipped their bat after a home run, you're going to give them a free base and possibly injure them in the process. Like, it makes zero sense to me. I mean,
it's ironic that their way of protecting their team and is by giving up a runner and putting them in danger of being suspended, things like that.
And you'd be kind of uniquely qualified, at least in the terms of our discussion here, to answer this question. But I mean, he in his article, Hayhurst talked a lot about kids, you know, and you're setting bad examples, like, mm-hmm. For instance, you know, he says Greg Dobbs is saying when you hit a guy, hits a home run and looks entirely too unhappy about it, the logical and correct response, the one that shows you how to handle disappointment, is to physically harm the perpetrator of his teammate, you know. So my question to you is that you coach Little League baseball, you help out with a lot of, you know, a lot of kids in their development with baseball. So, I mean, do you hear much of this? Like, how do they kind of react? Like, when somebody gets hit, is it their reaction to try and come? Because I mean, I'm pretty disconnected from Little League baseball at this point. So, I mean, is that still kind of feeding down into the Little Leagues, and how do you handle that as a coach when that kind of stuff comes up?
Well, we don't really run into it too much. It's a 14 and under league, so they're right in that spot where you kind of get, you know, to that point where you take a lot more pride in, you know, everything that's going on, rather than just being happy to be out there. You know, where this is about the age where winning starts to take priority over the fun and being out there with your friends, kind of part of it. Mm-hmm. But from what I've seen in, you know, the couple of leagues that I've helped in and some of the tournaments we've been to, there's not a lot of that. In some cases, I don't know if that's maybe because there's still developing players and merely executing a play is enough. But there are certain times where if one of our kids makes a play or something, they start kind of like screaming off the mound or something, we will say, hey, you know, don't be like that. You know, don't try to show up the opponent. And we don't really have much room for it. We haven't won a game yet this year, so we can't really do that. But I don't know. There have been times where we've played teams where the opposing coaches were, for lack of a better term, complete assholes. And you do kind of want to beat them. But you want to beat them on the scoreboard. You don't want to, you know, we're not going to tell a kid to hit somebody. And I don't think any coach in our league is going to tell someone to hit, you know, one of our kids. They're not big enough to hit home runs yet. So there's not really that kind of issue. So I don't see it really coming up, but I could definitely see, you know, when you get guys like, you know, Mitch Williams, was coaching a team in Texas or something and got involved in an incident with the umpire. And it's that same kind of thing where there's this mentality that, you know, everybody has to be the alpha. And I guess to get to the big leagues, you kind of have to, I suppose, because you have to be the best. But, you know, I think that's what drives a lot of this is that, you know, from the travel league to the tournament to the AAU to the high school level, you start really getting into that area where it's like, okay, you have to really, you know, show a lot of bluster and a lot of swagger and a lot of aggression and whatnot. And, you know, really show that, okay, you're not going to mess with me. And that's where a lot of this, I think, does come from, where you hit my guy, I'm going to hit yours. And that's the way that it's going to, you know, it's going to end up happening, so that, you know, you just keep hitting people, you know, settle scores. And even like other unwritten rules, like, you know, walking over the mound and stuff, that's enough to, you know, get someone to hit you or something. Or there could even be a slight somewhere in, you know, a different part of the game or in warmups or something, you know, who knows? And I think in that article, the Hayhurst mentions that, you know, there could be different criteria for what counts as an offense. On different teams. If you have 30 teams, you might have 30 different codes, and then you get free agency and teams changing players, and, you know, it mixes everything up. So, you know, that makes it even more absurd when you get down to it, because you have this supposed unwritten code of rules and ethics to abide by, and yet nobody really is following the same code. And I think that just muddles it up even more. So that you have silly behavior that keeps getting reinforced and that continues to, you know, change, and nobody really knows what it is. It's nebulous. And so it's really strange. I mean, the don't talk to someone during a no hitter, that's fine. But I don't think that wasn't really like the emphasis of what Hayhurst was talking about. It was more the retribution, you know, get angry, you're not disrespecting me, you're disrespecting the game kind of thing. Which to me, my way of respecting the game is to play it and play it hard and don't, you know, don't tank, don't loaf. And that's about it, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's kind of a cop out, because you're saying, oh, well, you're disrespecting the game, and it's just an excuse for you to act like an idiot, because you're trying to invoke, there's a word or a term for this type of an argument or whatever, but you're trying to invoke this greater idea of something you're trying to protect, when really you're just mad because you did something bad.
It's like the no true Scotsman thing almost. It's like, well, he's a ball player. Yeah, but no real ball player is going to do that.
Yeah, And I think a lot of this gets muddled too when you talk about, you know, showing up versus celebrating. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't have many teams in football that get angry when Chad Ochocinco does a that's probably a bad example. But
yeah, I'm probably getting mad
there
at
are
him,
some,
but
like, I mean,
there are guys
some, but,
will stir
but
the
those,
pot.
Those
but.
Guys actually do show up though. Like a Terrell Owens running to the star, the center star of the Dallas Cowboys stadium, you know. But when Dwayne Bowe's out there, Jamal Charles out there jumping into the stands and celebrating after a touchdown, teams aren't getting mad and doing stuff about that. You know, when LeBron James or, you know, whoever else, you know, throws down a really hard dunk and jaws at the camera, you know, he's not getting a huge foul on the other end in retaliation. So, and people might do a bat flip after they hit a home run, you know, because they're excited. They just did something good, and there's no way to really express yourself in baseball except with, you know, flipping the bat and maybe the way you run the bases when you're having a home run, because there's just no other time to really do that. So that, you know, I think there's a lot of people that do it, and it doesn't really bother me. And I don't know that, you know, I think 90% of them are just celebrating and they're not trying to show up a pitcher, but the pitcher is angry because he just gave up a home run and he sees a bat flip and, oh, that makes me even more angry. You know, it's like, well, don't screw up and you won't get angry anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's also like the stealing up five or six or something or things like that. And it's like, you're a major league ball player. Your job is to prevent them from getting that steal. So go prevent them from getting that stolen base. You know, that's the thing. You're running up the score. It's like, well, stop them. You know, that's your job. That's what you're supposed to do. If you can't do it, well, you just kind of have to take it.
Yeah, and kind of where we left off at the first segment is the ultimate argument that Hayhurst was getting at was, it was that it's all about the more or less old guard trying to keep their power, you know, trying to take away power from the new guard, more or less. And it's just, you know, it's the term he used was institutionalized bullying, almost,
mm-hmm.
where it's accepted and encouraged in most places to do this and to put down rookies and to not let them say things in the clubhouse and to not let them act however they want until they've reached a certain veteran status. And he brought up an interesting point that I thought he talked about Ken Griffey Jr. and how when he was growing up, Ken Griffey Jr. was the man, he was the guy and everybody loved him. And, you know, I mean, that was my generation and yours too, Mike. And he was it when we were kids. I mean, he was the guy. And
oh yeah,
he wore his hat backwards and he laughed and he smiled and he joked around and he was a jovial personality. And there were probably, I don't really remember because I just thought he was cool, but I mean, I'm sure there were, you know, people that were in the old guard back then that kind of thought, oh, who is this kid wearing his hat backwards? And, you know, and Hayhurst even mentioned that they would, in Little League, they would wear their hats backwards and their coaches would yell at them and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But eventually, you know, now you look back and people are like, oh, you know, Griffey was one of the good ones and, you know, he played the game hard and, you know, why can't people respect the game like that anymore and all that kind of stuff. And so he then kind of paralleled that with Yasiel Puig, where, you know, everyone hates him now because he has swagger and he does the bat flip and he's just outspoken and he, you know, does whatever he wants and he takes chances and he's aggressive and all this. Well, you know, 10 years from now, what are people going to think once he reaches a certain veteran status? And he's still good, and other players realize, hey, you know, I want him on my team because he's damn good, even if he flips his bat. You know, then what is it? You know, then is it still showing up, or then is it just, you know, he's earned his right? And because then he kind of segued that into Big Poppy out in Boston. Yep. Shows up a lot of home runs, basically makes it a spectacle every time he hits one in Fenway, and the crowd just loves it and reacts to it. And you know, is he showing up, or is he just playing up the crowd and making it, you know, a fun atmosphere? Or what's he doing? What's the difference with all this? And it's just so, you know, I thought that was that kind of stuff with baseball has been it's annoyed me for a long time. And I think it's good that finally not only somebody came out and started talking about it, but someone that had baseball experience.
Yeah, and you know, on the topic of like the I guess showboat type of guys, I mean, those guys have always been around. Babe Ruth was a showboat, you know, the Willie Mays to an extent could have been a showboat, you know. Just a lot of these different players would, they're just going to be excitable and they're going to do these things. And Jose Canseco is another guy, and Sammy Sosa, and just it goes on and on. There's always somebody who's going to show a little more flavor for the game and who's going to do these things. And I mean, it's not going to go away. That's who people want to emulate. Reggie Jackson is another guy, you know, talked all the time, and it's going to be there.
To keep going with the parallel narratives. I mean, then you have someone like Barry Bonds who, I mean, he wouldn't really flip his bat, but he would kind of do a little,
he would watch
step or whatever. And but he wasn't very vocal after the games. He didn't talk to the media a lot, and other than, you know, right after hitting the home run, he didn't do much, and people just hated him. You know, they said he was surly, and he was a bad thing in the clubhouse, and he had to be separated from everyone else and all this stuff. And, you know, it's regardless of whether or not, you know, how true that actually was, the whole idea of just, you know, how, why are different things acceptable for different people in different organizations? And it's just, not only is it all dumb, but then you're just going to compound the dumbness by changing the rules based on your geographic location.
Yeah, it's just pretty silly. I mean, I get to an extent like why that's in there, because it's a team and it's a teammate and you want to back up your teammate. But at the same time, it's like, why do you have to do it that way? You know, just if he shows you up, okay, get him next time.
Yeah, you know, if you want to protect your teammate, go out and protect the win. You know, protect the lead, get the lead back, get a lead to begin with, whatever. You know, that I would much rather hit a home run and say, hey man, you know, that's for you, because we're gonna win this game and show them who's better because they hit us or whatever. You know, I'd much rather do that than just be like, oh man, you know, we're gonna lose 6-2 here, but
we got him.
Being that guy, his shoulder is going to have a big welt tomorrow because I'm sticking up for you, man. Like, dude, this is totally awesome. You know, it's just, and I remember I would get that on Twitter. Like there was a time last year, I think, where somebody beaned somebody, or one of the Royals players got beaned, and then they were like, oh, the people on Twitter are like, oh, we're going to get him. Yeah, we're going to get him next inning. And I'm like, I hope to God they don't, because it's just so dumb. And people kind of came back at me and like, you don't understand. And, you know, you probably never played baseball and that's dumb. And, you know, it means a lot to these players. And I'm like, well, I don't doubt that it does, but that doesn't mean it's stupid. It doesn't mean it's not stupid. It's just because something is a reality, it doesn't mean that it's not, you know, that it should be accepted.
Just because that's how it's been done doesn't mean that's how it should still be done.
Yes.
It does get pretty absurd. It's confusing. I do get why it, you know, how it survives though. I mean, Harris really explains that well. You've got the veterans and they indoctrinate the rookies, and then the rookies, you know, they learn that behavior and then they pass it on to the next ones, and it just feeds itself.
It's just like I was in a fraternity. It's just like fraternity hazing, you know, because then you have people that were hazed, and they go, and then they haze the people younger that were them or younger than them. And it's all, this was so much harder for us. These kids have it so easy and need to, you know, we need to make it even harder and all this stuff. And it's like, no, we don't, you know, that's stupid. You know, just because you think you had it so hard, you know, it's just, it's dumb. And, you know, I don't mind certain unwritten rules in sports if it seems like they have a purpose, but yeah. They don't really have, these don't really have a purpose for the most part. And if they do, it's kind of mangled. And, you know, the you hit us, we hit you thing, like
there's a better way to go about it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to, the quote unquote policing the game aspect is something that people hide behind to justify, you know, endangering someone's health. I mean, how many players, I mean, Omar Infante missed games because it wasn't on purpose, but you know, he missed games because he was hit in the jaw. And you've had players break. I mean, Jorge Bonifacio last year broke his hamate bone because he got hit. You know, you've had people break fingers and all that kind of stuff. And you're basically, you know, increasing exponentially the percentages of that happening by trying to hit someone. And I mean, I just don't understand how players can think that that's not only accepted but necessary when, if it was unprovoked and someone just said, oh, I'm going to hit David Ortiz, then they'd be blacklisted because, you know, well, he's a star of the game and you can't hit him. And then Bud Ellis way hits somebody else. And
that's their livelihood. And so they've got to, I agree. It's pretty absurd. I mean, I get that they want to protect, but there is a much better way to do it and just go win the game. You know, just go win it. It, you know, you don't have to be the macho caveman all the time.
Yeah, and to kind of connect our first segment and with our second here, this all kind of especially when talking about the Royals, don't know much about any of the unwritten rules the Royals have besides forcing people to carry Justin Bieber backpacks or whatever.
Right.
This old guard idea of how things are done. This is what baseball people do. This is how baseball people think and how they do it, and what's always been done. And we're going to do it because it succeeded, you know, at this point, and that's what we're going to do. And the game hasn't, you know, well, the game hasn't evolved, so we don't have to, because it looks the same as it did 30 years ago. It's like, well, you know, if you just glance at it and you're watching it on TV, maybe it kind of looks the same as it did in the early 80s, but it's not. The game has evolved. The rules have evolved. The players have to, and the front offices have to as well. And, you know, it just to kind of encompass everything we've talked about, it just seems like so far to this point, you know, Dayton Moore has not shown that ability. And whether it's unwritten rules or development or whatever, it's kind of one of the things that we've been talking about on this show that has been holding the Royals back for the last few years.
Yep. It's okay to walk out into the light.
Yes, exactly. No one is going to laugh at you if you're winning games. Do whatever you want. If you want to make a mathematical equation and fire everybody but one person to hit a button on a computer to make all your decisions and you win games, people can laugh all they want. You know, I don't care. But people
flags fly forever.
Indeed. So I think with that, we'll wrap this up here. Hope you enjoyed the show. We talked about, did a little Royals recap, and even got a little play-by-play in there.
A little bit.
It's tied up in the bottom of the fifth as we leave this show. So you'll know the result, as will we, by the time you listen to this. Hopefully it's a good one. Hopefully the Royals can win their second straight and then take two more from the Cardinals back in Kauffman. I would love a four-game sweep.
Oh, that'd be great. Cardinals. That would be awesome.
But hopefully that will happen. We will see. I'm not holding my breath.
No, I'm not either. That would be silly, but you know, whatever.
Whatever. All right. Well,
one more thing before we go. Okay. On Thursday, it's going to be the first round of the MLB draft. Right. We haven't talked hardly at all about the draft. It's, for me, I find it difficult to keep up with, you know, the billions of college programs and high school programs and players, and you know, up until about a week. Until the draft. But on Thursday, Dave Leske and Clint Scholes are going to be doing a Google Hangout during the draft to kind of talk about some things. The first two rounds are on the first day, and then there's some other rounds on the next day, and then they do pretty much like 40 rounds in one day. Yeah, it's like literally it'll be done in like 2 hours and they'll go through 40 rounds. But they're going to be talking on Thursday, and they, you know, on Pine Tar Press, there's profiles of a lot of different players. We've been doing 3 or 4 a week, you know, so pretty much encompass top 40 guys. Royals pick 17th. They have 4 picks in the top 56. I would recommend go to Pine Tar Press and listen to their podcast. They're going to be well up to speed on any draft coverage you might want to think about.
Yeah, and jump on that Google Hangout, right?
Yep.
Yep. Jump on that Google Hangout, and you got any questions for them, send them their way, and they'll be more than happy to answer.
Leske won't be happy, but
he's never happy. He's just an unhappy individual.
True. Oh.
We love David Leske on this show. But with that, we'll leave you. So we'll have some draft to talk about. Hopefully the Royals will have an exciting player next week, and hopefully they'll have a nice little win streak. Maybe they'll be 500. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Maybe. We're a game closer.
Yes. Last time there were 4 games. This time there are 3. Maybe next week there'll be 2 games. And who knows, by the end of the season, maybe they'll be above 500. We'll see. So with that, we'll leave you from this edition of Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. So tune in next week. This show should, well, you know, doesn't matter when this should be up, because you'll be listening to it. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.